to one.
Hello.
It's have to do with it. Maybe a little louder. 1 2 1 2. Yeah.
1 2 1. 1 2 1.
Yeah, that's what we're starting with. We are inside of Brixton, inside a kind of information center. It's called 1 2 1. Can you tell us when it opened?
It was squatted in 1981 by a group of anarchists who'd been working around here for a few years, and they decided they needed a centre to sort of help their activities. So they squatted it, an empty, it was a black bookshop that closed down, and they squatted, after it closed down, they squatted it and turned it into an anarchist information centre and bookshop.
They had an idea with it, why they want to make a bookshop?
Yeah, well, there was different people who started it with different ideas. Some people wanted to run a cafe, sort of cheap food and a meeting space. And then some people wanted to there wasn't any really anywhere putting out decent anarchist books and pamphlets. And also as a centre for meeting and using for advice for squatting and for coordinating squatting action, which there wasn't really in South London at all at the time.
Is it? It's now 10 years later. Has changed the idea about it, or?
Well, yeah. I mean, these days, I mean, it's still very much an anarchist bookshop and a squatter's advice place. But there's not so much squatting around these days, and there's not so many. We're not concentrating on squatting so much as trying to make the place a resource centre for the community and getting out to more people. We've still got a calf now and again. So using it as an information centre and a meeting space for local people. That's what we're trying to aim at now.
You're rebuilding the place. Yeah. Is there a reason for it?
Yeah. Well, the building's been is in very bad condition, and what we're trying to do is make it a lot more attractive place, like taking out some useless walls, making big rooms, and where you can fit more space in, like having a space where you can show videos and a space where people can sort of sit around and talk and drink cups of coffee, and sort of trying to extend the calf to make more of a bar sort of area as well.
Also to be more open for new people to come in?
Yeah, I mean, this is an argument that goes on, that the place looks very sort of squatty and run down. And so people are sort of, we're trying to do it up so it's more of an attractive place. Like later on, we're going to rebuild the front so it's painted like bright colours instead of sort of old anarchist red and black. And it looks a bit messy, but now we're trying to make it a real attractive place, I think.
But it's now only for in-crowd people who come inside?
Pretty much, yeah.
So you hope that if you have a new bride outside, there's coming also people of the neighbourhood inside?
Not necessarily. I mean, we've got to do other work as well, like on making it more of a... offering things here that are going to interest people, like a social space, and advertise more cheap food and have more a cafe on every day, and a pool table so that people can come in and play pool, and we're hoping to get discos going again in the basement as well, which always used to be really popular with the community around here. There was a lot of local people who'd come in to the discos when they were on.
This information centre is inside of Brixton. Is it necessary that you have this kind of information centre?
Well, I think it's necessary. I think there's a lot of things going on in Brixton, in Lambeth, in South London, which need...
Explain what kind of neighbourhood it is.
Right. What? Brixton?
Brixton, yeah.
Well, Brixton's it's much like a pretty much black working class area with a lot of black, sort of Afro-Caribbean black people. But I mean, also a lot of, it's kind of like also an area where there's been a lot of squatting in the past and a lot of working class people living here in the past. And over the last 10 years, I mean, most people know about the Brixton riots, sort of 81. But since then, there's been a lot of kind of effort by the authorities to do it up and split up the communities, sort of move yuppies into the area and sort of brighten the place up, sort of to break up the resistance that goes on in the community. And I think that has worked quite a bit. To some extent, the community is very sort of split up, and they've evicted a lot of squatters and moved people out, and they're sort of threatening the kind of like the black social scene, which is very much a street culture. They're threatening that now by doing work on the area, doing up the streets, moving people on, etc. And I mean, I think that 121, sort of like, if it could get into dialogues with people around here a lot more, then we could sort of make it a focus for resistance to that kind of cult sort of attack on local people.
So the government only works on the outside problem to move in people with more money, and didn't do anything about the inside problems, unemployment and things like that?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, they say they are addressing things like that, but obviously they're not. You know, there isn't. We are. Britain's in a recession, and there aren't that many jobs around. This area, Lambeth, Brixton area, is one of the poorest areas in the country, and even with the sort of the yuppies that have been moved into the area. But yeah, I mean that's their solution. Is not. It, while they might be doing sort of certain things to try and get more jobs, then their priority is to split up neighbourhoods or areas where there might be resistance or riots or organisation against them, and this is one area where that might happen. I mean, it's very different to 10 years ago, but it might happen again.
But can you see in this area the result of the Thatcher politics?
Well, how do you mean by Thatcher politics?
No, about the economic politics, about the government, the right-wing government in England.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean,
what I see is in the whole of London, a lot of houses for sale, and people are living in the parks. And
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of poverty around here, for instance. Yeah, I mean, there are people living on the streets. There's a lot of there's empty houses, and I mean, even some of the sort of people who are moving upwards who bought houses around here, are now sort of losing their jobs, and now they're having to sell up, and sort of there's a lot of for sale signs. But yeah, yes, there is a lot of effect of sort of that kind of those policies on Brixton. But then again, it's also an area where, in some parts of Brixton, the community sort of stands together a lot to help people. I mean, in other areas that might not happen, but in some parts of Brixton, the sort of people do get supported by each other. But I mean, I think there's a lot of kind of hostility as well. There's a lot of the sort of last 10 years have brought a lot of hostility between people, sort of that's been created by the government and by sort of policies which have divided people a lot as well.
Is there also dividing between the white community and the black community?
Yeah. I mean, but it's not sort of fatal division. It's sort of cultural, basically. They've got one particular sort of culture, and there's white people involved in that culture, and it mixes with the white culture as well, and there's crossovers. But I mean a lot of black people around here are obviously distrustful of sort of white people because of the racism that goes on, and I mean, there are crossovers. It's not kind of like all simple as that, and there's a lot of mixing of culture as well.
It's not like living apart together.
No, it's not. I mean, not really. I mean, there's hostilities between sort of obviously between different sets of people, but I think there's potential for people to sort of get together. It's just that, I mean, in London very much most people are atomized, if you know what I mean. Most people are divided from each other and split up and sort of at a distance and not kind of working together and talking together all the time and mixing. And I think when people tend to gather in Brixton, it tends to go by, you know, the black people gather together, because it's kind of, I don't know, it seems kind of natural, really.
You said there were a lot of empty houses. Is there results for the squatting movement, that they have more opportunity to get a house? Or?
No, it's very difficult to squat in London, and very, very difficult in this area, because I mean, most of the houses that people would squat would be owned by the local council, which, and recently, in the last 2-3 years, local councils in London, especially Lambeth, which is the one that covers Brixton, has been evicting squatters very fast, and making the houses very difficult to re-squat. and leaving some of them empty, housed, but putting some people in others, which is good that people are getting housed. But then, if you do re-squat the places, then you get evicted again almost immediately by the council in a lot of cases. And so the squatting movement's gone down in Brixton. I mean, a lot of people have moved out of Brixton into other areas.
How is the history of the squatting movement? Well, when it's starting it?
Well, I mean, I suppose there's been squatting on and off for hundreds of years in this country. I mean, it's a very old tradition of land squatting in Britain. And there was a lot of, I mean, there's been squatting, there was big squatters movement after the Second World War from returning soldiers and their families. But I mean, the most recent sort of movement kind of started in 1968 when people started sort of squatting, like homeless families and that, started squatting in East London. And then that spread very quickly to sort of like, into a kind of movement where there was sort of like counterculture people and homeless families and sort of left-wing people sort of squatting a lot of empty property. And during the 70s, that was quite well organised, and people got together in strong groups and formed into co-ops and sort of got a lot off the state and off local councils for themselves. And I think into the 80s, it's been very divided between a lot of the old squatters sort of went into co-ops, got licences, and have got quite sort of secure. And sort of younger people and people sort of starting squatting in late 70s, 80s. Sort of like anarchist, more sort of anarchist types again, but also a lot of Irish people, black people coming here. It's got a lot more difficult, and there's not been as much organisation in the 80s. It's been going downhill. I mean, there's been sort of big instances where there's been resistances to evictions in the 80s, but it's very much a kind of, it's like retreating movement. And it's into the 90s, it's really, you can really sort of see the end of squatting, you know, possibly on the horizon.
But that is the result of the repression? It was
say in the 60s, 70s, there was like councils and private landlords, there was really like thousands of empty houses which were just left empty, and that provided a lot of places for the squatters to go to. And also there wasn't a real unity on the behalf of the council and the government about what they wanted to do about squatters. They had different ideas about how to deal with it. Some people wanted to give out licences, some people wanted to just evict people, etc. And now, I think, at the end of the 70s, sort of early 80s, they pretty much they've got the respectable people out of the squatting movement and sort of got them into co-ops. And now they're sort of being... They started to attack squatters as sort of like being, you know, obviously parasites, you know, stealing houses, etc. And they got more together about evicting people. They got, you know, the legal department got more practiced at going to court, and they worked out ways of evicting people without going to court very easily, which made it easier for them to evict squatters like en masse, like sort of. They could sort of go to court and evict 20, get 20, 30 flats, and you know, and then evict them all in one day, and then board them all up or whatever. And also, I mean, there was a Housing Act made by the government, which is a law made by the government about in 1988, which started to take money off local councils for having empty property, and empty property included squatted property. Which meant that councils really had to get their act together and evict squatters and put people in empty flats, or else they were going to lose money from the government. And because the government's already attacking local councils, taking money off them, local councils are really sort of stretched to the limit. I mean, so that they were sort of like didn't want to lose any more money, and it was a kind of opportunity. It was like pressure from the central government down on local councils to evict squatters. With the ideas that already local councils already had for evicting squatters, and since 1988, it's really been a sort of full scale attack on the whole thing, the idea of squatting and all squatters, really.
But there is still existing a squatters movement.
Well, there's still squatting. Whether there's a movement is another matter. There's three or four local advice groups who are sort of like do some action around squatting in London, and there's about sort of 6 to 10 probably outside London in other cities in the in England, and there's very loose contacts. I mean, the problem was that squatters have never been very good at uniting as a movement, because it's been very easy for a long time to get away with squatting houses and living there for a long time, and then you get evicted and then you move on, and it's not really been much of a problem.
It was a way to get easy out.
Yeah, it was. I mean, which is, and I mean, you know, that's fair enough in that it allowed sort of 30,000-40,000 people, even now, to have free housing when they wouldn't have any access to housing otherwise. But it means that most people would sort of using squatters groups like in a consuming way, sort of getting advice, finding out about court cases, finding out about empty places, borrowing tools, etc., but not putting things back into the squatting group, which meant that squatting groups are very much kind of activist based, which meant really, I mean, the same people running these groups, and in the end, you know, it's very much, it's more than those people can cope with. And there isn't really a movement in as such. There's a kind of scene, squatters, there's different squatters scenes. Obviously there's kind of your anarchist squatters who have a lot of links with each other, and sort of certain actions and campaigns come out of that. But on the other hand, there's a wider group of squatters who are basically squatting for somewhere to live, which is fair enough, and aren't really interested in the political sort of implications. But I mean, unfortunately now the government's talking about criminalising squatting, or criminalising certain aspects of squatting, which would mean that obviously a lot more people would be forced onto the streets. And it's very difficult for the squatters groups that exist to actually get out to a lot of these squatters who don't necessarily use the squatters groups, and sort of say, look, we've got to get together, we've got to unite, our housing's under threat, etc.
But the people who were politically active, they were also involved in other things.
Yeah.
For example, when the politics came up, they organised themselves.
I mean, most of the sort of squatting activists are also anarchists or of similar ideas, and there was a lot of crossover between those people and the anti-poll tax movement. But then the anti-poll tax movement was basically the biggest thing that's happened in for about 10-20 years in this country. Like, politically, it united sort of the whole sort of working class of this country, which
but why the anti-poll tax movement could make that link with the big society and the squatters movement didn't?
Well,
because everyone had to,
in theory, pay the poll tax, so everyone was threatened by it. And even like, I mean, the anti-poll tax movement had a lot of successes in uniting people and getting local groups working and getting activists in touch with each other. But then when the poll tax was sort of, they decided to get rid of the poll tax, a lot of that fell apart, because a lot of the people involved in the movement were just anti-poll tax activists, and when that was kind of seen as being sort of just about defeated, which it isn't yet, then a lot of people sort of dropped out and didn't want to carry on and make sort of general community links and campaign. I mean, some people did, and there's been a lot of successes in those areas, like in Scotland, sort of areas of Glasgow and Edinburgh. There's some powerful sort of local groups come out of this anti-poll tax movement, which means that those are going to carry on and deal with other issues. And also in certain parts of London, like in Camden and in Tottenham, sort of Haringey, which is they're both in North London, there's been sort of very strong anti-poll tax groups have gone on to sort of expand into general sort of solidarity organisations. And that potential was seen by a lot of people, but it wasn't necessarily worked for. I mean, a lot of anarchists were saying at the beginning of the poll tax movement that could happen, and that could increase sort of community activism and links between workplaces and communities and links between people, which would create a strong movement of resistance. But then I think in a lot of cases people didn't put enough of that forward, and didn't sort of put the politics forward, and very much kept it to a sort of single issue thing, which meant that a lot of people fell out when it sort of ended.
So the government had the opportunity again to split up this movement.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, I mean, obviously a lot of people aren't, millions of people aren't paying the poll tax, and the problem is that because the poll tax was very difficult to administer, I mean, it's very difficult to actually get money off people without, I mean, they can send people to jail or they can come and take your possessions away, but if people don't want to pay, it's very difficult to sort of actually get the money off them, which means that there isn't really much incentive to organise in a lot of ways, that a lot of people could resist the poll tax just by ignoring it all, which meant that for the people who maybe couldn't ignore it, who were under most threat, say families, people with kids, or pensioners, who were intimidated by the thought of going to jail, and obviously intimidated by having the possessions taken away, and intimidated by the whole sort of method, by using bailiffs and the whole language of the poll tax, then those people were the people who were isolated more, whereas the sort of young single sort of in London, especially sort of people who move around a lot, say, you know, squatters or sort of young people who move around, don't live in one place, move from job to job, that it's very easy for them to avoid the poll tax, and in a lot of ways they were the people with the most time and energy to organize against it, but they were the people who are most sort of like not really interested in it. I mean, for instance, I mean, there's been very strong organisation against the poll tax among pensioners because they're most under threat in a lot of ways because they've got, you know, very little money. They can't move as easily. They're often in housing where they're going to live for quite a long time, and quite a lot of people over 60 have been sent to prison. I mean, including sort of 80-year-old people have been sent to prison for refusing to pay, and that's sort of brought a lot of there's pensioners sort of links, networks across the country which are starting up kind of to resist the poll tax, which is, I mean, it's really good, and it's, I mean, you get all these people who are sort of, they sort of go back to the 1920s or whatever and talk about the general strike and sort of old communists sort of coming out of the woodwork and people who are sort of in the miners' strike and everything, and they sort of all come out and, you know, they're really good, sort of like really active and strong, and in a lot of ways they're sort of more revolutionary than sort of your anarchist, but I mean I don't know. I think the poll tax movement had a lot of potential that wasn't fulfilled, but then in a lot of ways it's a rolling process in that people get involved in things and maybe drop out, but they still keep in mind the general idea of what's happening, and they sort of maybe keep seeing the same people they've been working with socially, and then when things come along again, then sort of people sort of wake up again and get involved, and it's just a rolling thing where you've got to work at sort of keeping basic movement going, and then, you know, when the big issues that really affect people come up, then people will sort of wake up and take part again. And I mean, it's an old debate among anarchists in this country, anarchists and political activists and sort of revolutionaries in this country, which is how to keep things going when the general sort of working class is demoralised. And now, I mean, things are falling apart quite a lot here. I mean, for squatting, anti-poll tax, anarchist movement, sort of resistance movement generally, and workers, you know, trade unions, workers' movements, it's all very much sort of at low level, which I don't know. It's disillusion, and it feeds off itself. If people get disillusioned, then things don't happen, and if things don't happen, people get disillusioned. So it gets into a real circle,
big spiral down.
Yeah, downwards. But I mean, it's not totally negative. I mean, that's why we'd like to see 121 as a kind of more resource centre, which it means that if there's anything that people want to know about or want to get involved in resistance, then they know that people from 121 are involved in it, and they know that there'll be information on it at 121, and there'll be information about prisoners, there'll be information about anti-poll tax, about squatting, about struggles around the world, about there'll be a social space where you can go and meet people, and that's why we'd like to see 121 as kind of more of a space for local people in a lot of ways.
Is it not the squatters movement like this, that if you have problems here in the neighborhood, people are not coming to here? That if, for example, people have problems to pay the poll tax,
yeah,
that, well, they come to here to organize? Or Maybe is that a problem? There's a big link between the politic activists and the normal people who are living.
That's a problem as well. That activists just get alienated from everybody else, because so many people just spend all the time sort of in political meetings and on demonstrations and stuff. They don't actually sort of have time to go and talk to the people on the street where they live, and which is it's a big problem. And it's those links between people which are essential, because those people have got as much ideas about politics and resistance and what's going on as the activists, but they're not as confident about airing them. Hang on a minute, let me turn it off. Okay. And there are things that go on around here. When the poll tax movement first started, people from 121 were very active in it for about 3 years. But then it's very much died down round this area, because Lambeth is one area where the council has just about given up in a lot of cases trying to get money off people, especially poor people round here, because they've not so much given up, but it's been people nobody's paying hardly round here, so that
they have money to pay it.
No, not really. But the people who do have money to pay it, sort of like a little money to pay it, aren't paying it, and the council sort of just virtually accepted that they're not going to get very much money off people. But then there is still an anti-poll tax advice group, but that was taken over by a left-wing group, and they're sort of using that for their own propaganda. And when we were involved in the anti-poll tax movement, I was involved in it for about 3 years. We used to have running fights with them about sort of, they always wanted to control the groups, and we were trying to sort of widen them out and make them more open to working people around here, and make them into active groups, whereas they just wanted kind of paper organisations that they could control and sort of like have like foot soldiers that they could get out for their demos and stuff, which meant that we were active in trying to help people to organise their own groups, but also active in trying to sort of like fight against lefty domination. It's the militant tendency who are a sort of Labour Party parasite, except they've left the Labour Party now. And they...
They kicked out.
Yeah, well, they voted to leave, in fact, because they all thought they got so much publicity out of the poll tax movement, they decided that they could be a left-wing party by themselves, but I give them 3 years and they'll be knocking back on the door to get in the Labour Party. But which the problem was, if you're trying to organise on a local level and fight against left-wing control by these groups, then you're very much burning out, and you're spending your whole time sort of running between different groups of poll tax groups, and in the end a lot of people got tired of it and dropped out, sort of like left-wing libertarian independent activists, and a lot of working class people got pissed off with the militant control of things. And it's been shown that basically it's in areas where the militant haven't had control, and where there's been genuine grassroots anti-poll tax groups, where the movement's gone from strength to strength and gone and made links with other campaigns and made links with prisoners groups and done very good support for prisoners, poll tax prisoners. And in militant areas, they've just been like really sectarian and useless, basically, and not much good to anybody. But around here, they control what anti-poll tax stuff there is, which is very little. It's just one advice group that for the whole area that meets once a month. And I've made repeated attempts in the last couple of years to try and get class-based anti-poll tax groups going again, but no one but me seems to be interested. So I'll give.
How were these poll tax groups organised? Was it organised from down under or from up to down?
Well, right, there was different sort of tendencies, right? There was a lot of anarchists and sort of independent activists were trying to build up local groups that were based grassroots upwards, so that there'd be membership be open to everybody, and you'd have meetings which were organised, and everything would be decided at meetings, and that nobody would sort of have power over other people. And then they'd be federated upwards into regional groups, etc. But then, in a lot of areas that worked, and a lot of the groups that are still surviving were organised like that, sort of, I mean, methods of organisation which were anti-hierarchical, and that they involved the most amount of people, and sort of new people were sort of joining who were equal to everybody else, and it wasn't sort of like an activist clique sort of telling other people what to do. But then on the other hand, there was a lot of groups which were taken over by left-wing groups, like...
What do you mean by left-wing?
Well, I'd say like Trotskyist groups, such as the Militant Tendency, Socialist Workers' Party, Workers' Power, and various others who were all... They're basically organised hierarchically on the level of top-down, where you've got like a central committee, and even in most cases there's usually a leader as well. And it's all organised downwards, and people take orders from the top. And these groups move in on quite a lot of struggles in this country and try and take them over for their own advantages, like recruiting members to their organisation. And the two big ones who really did that in the poll tax struggle were the Socialist Workers' Party and the Militant Tendency, especially the Militant. And they took over a lot of groups, set up groups that didn't really exist. Like, say they would have a group in an area that was supposed to exist but didn't actually do anything. It was just a membership organisation, and it meant that they could have a delegate to the regional federation who was actually just a militant member with another coat on, basically. And a lot of these groups were basically fronts for them. And say, for instance, if an independent group was going that they couldn't control in some areas, they would come along and set another group up in that area to try and divide people so that they could get a group they could control. And this really, I mean, a lot of this sort of sabotaged the poll tax movement in a lot of areas quite badly, which meant that, you know, I mean, obviously if there's divisions between people, then it's really hard for people to sort of unite or get together against something if there's divisions between people at the base. And I think it was pretty much shown that the groups that worked, that went on to create a sort of active resistance to the poll tax, like resisting bailiffs, fighting court cases effectively, you know, defending people against police attacks on demonstrations, etc., were independent or were organised, like sort of like with along the lines of the way that the anarchists were suggesting. But I mean, the anarchists were only a small part of them. Most of the sort of independent working class people who were getting involved and were actually sort of like working along those lines. And I think it could be said that a lot of the problems that the poll tax movement had were to do with the conflict between the independent groups trying to resist the poll tax and the left-wing hierarchical mostly Trotskyist groups trying to take it over.
What do you think? You have this problem, I think, more often in England. How you think a movement should be organised? Or,
well, I mean, I'm an anarchist. I call myself an anarchist, right? Which is, I mean, that a lot. Anarchist means a lot of things for different people, but I mean, to me, it means that life, basically, all of life, everyone's lives should be under their own control to the extent that local areas, communities, workplaces should be run by the people who use them and live and run them and live there. So, and I think that as a method of struggle, that as a way of life, which is an end for me, is also the way of struggle, which is like that local organisations in workplaces, in communities, in, you know, in the local area, linking together, talking to each other, you know, basically based on people's experiences, based on the local conditions, working together grassroots upwards, not sort of controlled by a central committee which might operate in London, say. I mean, we are in London, but won't have any relevance possibly to sort of a little village in Wales. But then there might be people sort of coming and trying to tell them what to do, but the people in that area are going to know more effectively, like, the method of struggle that's going to work in that area. And I think that's the only practical way of winning. I mean, I'm not interested in glorious defeats. I'm interested in the long run, winning the social revolution worldwide so that we can get rid of capitalist system forever, but also winning local areas, local disputes, strikes, riots, you know, unemployed action. I'm interested in winning all the time. Like, there's no point in being defeated. Like, it's you learn from it, but it's a negative thing. It makes it demoralises people. And I think the way to win is to get the method of struggle that is relevant for the time and for the people who are involved.
Yeah, but sometimes the problem for organising down under is that everybody can do what he likes. From how you see that problem?
Well, I mean, there's a certain amount of discipline that has to, I mean, common discipline that people agree to when they join organisations and when they join local groups, when they join collectives, that I think there should be a certain amount of discipline agreed between those people. And I've seen it work in some ways where if people have got to be informed about a certain amount of responsibility and commitment that joining that collective or organisation means, and that you can't sort of be out of order in a way of, like, for instance, you can't use racism against other people in the group. You know, you can't, if you're on a demonstration and you've agreed that it's going to be a peaceful demonstration, then you can't allow drunken people to sort of start throwing bricks at the police when we're going to lose if there's a fight. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a risk.
But you see it many times when demonstrations are that people throwing rocks in moments, so then the police get attacked and then your organization fell down and. Yeah. So it can be a lot of problems with it also.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, it's a dialogue that's got to go on, obviously, but I think there's a certain amount that organisations have to do to make it clear as well, to say, well, look, these people, you know, that what we're trying to do, we're aiming at certain things, like certain level of organisation, certain practical aims, certain political aims. And if people sort of individuals who come along who are irresponsible and who are throwing rocks or whatever on demonstrations are going to come along and do that in defiance of the common sort of agreement between the people in that group, then it's got to be accepted among those people as well as among the organisation, I think, that those people should be thrown out of the movement, and that you shouldn't tolerate people who are going to do things like that on a totally stupid level and threaten the unity of the whole group of people because they're drunk or, you know, irresponsible, or they don't know how to behave themselves. I mean, that may sound very sort of like harsh and you know whatever. I mean, some people, I mean, I've been called a fascist for throwing people out of places and refusing to let people, you know, into gigs if they're being out of order. But I mean, I don't consider it fascist to think that a certain amount of discipline is expected of people, self-discipline. I mean, I think that's fair enough.
But it's not like the autonoms that you have, everybody can do what he likes. You have to have a responsibility in your own organisation.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about from my point of view at the minute. I mean, I'm not a member of an organisation except that I'm a member of a prisoner support collective and 121 and a broader anarchist movement. I'm not speaking as a representative of anybody, but I mean, I think this is fairly agreed between sort of most class struggle anarchists, I'd say, in this country, that for a long time the anarchist movement has sort of addressed itself to sort of people who are very irresponsible, very anti-organisation, a kind of underclass kind of mentality, you know, fuck everybody else, you know, we're right, you know. And I think that's a very that's a dead end. And the kind of people who sort of go on demonstrations to throw stones, when obviously if it's a demonstration of a few people and a lot of police, then you're going to lose if there's a fight. And you know, I mean, we shouldn't be into the business of creating massacres. We should be into the business of keeping ourselves going as organisations and broadening out and making ourselves a power to be reckoned with. And I think things that threaten that should, you know, people that threaten that should be told, you know, to wise up or get out. And I think, I mean, it's idealistic. I mean, obviously there will always be people who are stupid and who do things that cause problems for demonstrations and cause problems for groups, but I think it's part of what I'm suggesting is a dialogue to get people to accept that the people that we want to talk to are also, you know, the wider people out there, wider working class people who aren't necessarily into going on demonstrations to sort of get masked up and, you know, get drunk and just have a fight all the time. There's more to organising a resistance than that.
There's going a discussion on in London from how you have to organise yourselves, or how to look at this kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, there's always it's very at the moment it's very bad. I mean, one of the things I'd like to see going on at 121 is what we used to do before, is have discussion meetings about how to organise and about particular struggles and particular aspects of theory, and sort of like, you know, have them open for anyone to come along, and then we can discuss them and sort of maybe, you know, write down the notes and circulate them to people who weren't at the meeting, so that, you know, open discussion meetings to discuss how the movement, the wider movement, goes onward. I mean, it does go on to a certain extent that people discuss how to go forward, but there's no structure allowed for it, so that it's very like, I mean, the best discussions I've had have been sort of like, you talk to people in a pub after a demonstration and you talk about it and you come up with some brilliant ideas, and then the next morning you wake up and you've got a hangover and you forget them. And I think some of those ideas should be set down and sort of passed around. And in a lot of ways, for struggles in this country, some really good ideas come up, and really good methods of working together, and really good methods of struggle. And then when that particular strike or whatever is over, then they get forgotten until the next one comes up. And so every time we have to learn again and build up new organisations and build up new ideas and build up strategies. And I think it's very sad that happens all the time, when we could possibly be having ongoing groups that are keeping it alive. Or I mean, it doesn't have to. I don't know. I'm not suggesting a structure. I'm just saying there are ways of keeping ideas and keeping methods of struggle and keeping people working together when there isn't necessarily a sort of massive resistance going on. But through the low periods, as an example, the miners' strike, a lot of activists who were active in miners' support groups during the miners' strike in 1984-85, and sort of like, you know, were sort of turned up again, sort of in the print work, supporting the print workers' strike in Wapping in East London, 1986-87, and then surfaced again sort of during the poll tax movement. And those people aren't sort of political activists, members of groups necessarily, but they're working people who sort of by instinct know that they have to stand with other working people and support them, and not because of some sort of grand set of theories that's written down in three massive big books written 200 years ago or whatever, but because, you know, it's a living thing for them that they've got to be part of the defence of their class against attacks by the government. And I think there's a lot of potential for people to link together and build up ongoing structures. Not anti-hierarchical structures that are federated, local groups who know what's going on in their area, know which ways of work, know the local contacts, know the local pubs, know the people who live there, know who's likely to come out for what, you know, and who's going to come out for a demonstration, who's going to get involved in things. And those groups can be ongoing, and, you know, they could be low level, they could just be, you know, carrying on with the things that's going on when there's not much going on. But when the big struggles come along, then they're there, and they know the people, they know the contacts, and they can get people motivated quickly and get organised quickly. And I think it's a possibility. I mean, there's the suggestions. There are moves afoot to do that. I mean, there's a group which is setting up. Well, it's been set up for a couple of years, and it's collapsed, and it's setting up again, called the Solidarity Network, which is designed to support strikes from a non-sectarian, anti dogmatic point of view, just supporting strikes practically and publicising information about them around the country, so that other people around the country know that that's going on and can support it. And also there's this there's a group who are proposed to have a local federation of local solidarity organisations in London, based in the different areas and working together. And all those different groups are active in their neighbourhood, but they sort of meet every so often, come together, discuss what's going on, you know, the struggles they're involved in, and then, you know, discuss the best way of going about things, people learning off each other, and then they can go back to their areas, you know, work in their areas. And I think those kind of links, obviously they're being built up all the time, but it's just important not to sort of make them a hierarchical structure. It's important to make them into a kind of a structure that's going to draw people in and attract people, rather than put people off, because, you know, people don't like to take orders. People like to think for themselves, work for themselves, do things on their own back, you know. I think that's pretty much standard in this country anyway.
This is the local politics of your own organization. if you are a local group, there is also a discussion going on about Europe, 92.
Well, I mean,
it's far away.
England's been England's notoriously bad about linking up with people in other countries. I mean, English sort of revolutionaries, anarchists, whatever. Are, I mean, we are very isolated. I mean, it's part of the, I mean, the thing of this society is very much coming down on people to be sort of like, you know, part of England and not part of Europe. Still, I mean, after all these years, and we are. I mean, there are people who are making links and sort of putting out information about Europe '92 and international struggles in Europe that we're trying to link into. Particularly anti-fascist stuff. I mean, people from anti-fascist action in this country have been going over to Germany and France and linking up with people there and passing on experiences to do with fighting fascism and swapping experiences and bringing, you know, obviously bringing ideas back. And also,
is that one of the common problems there is in Europe?
I think so. I mean, it's not as big as in England as in Germany and sort of other parts of the East, I think. I mean, the fascist groups here are quite small still. They're not like sort of big organisations with a lot of influence. I think there's a wider sort of base racism in a lot of people, but I wouldn't necessarily say that those people were. I mean, they're obviously not fascists, and it's obviously possible to talk to a lot of working class people and sort of talk to them about racism, and you know, just point out to them, like, you know, how they're being used basically by ruling class to divide each other by, you know, by being racist against black people. But there's small hardcore fascist organisations, and they're slowly growing, I think, in this country. It's not like a massive sudden growth. They're slowly sort of picking up recruits, but I mean, there's a very effective anti-fascist movement in this country, I think. I mean, again, there's a problem with left-wing hierarchical Trotskyist groups trying to take it over. But I think there's quite a strong Asian youth movement in quite a lot of parts of the country who are very actively anti-fascist. And there's Anti-Fascist Action, which is quite a strong group, has got a lot of experience in physically fighting fascism, like clearing them off the streets, etc. And has developed over the last few years, has developed working with local anti-racist groups and community groups to try and set up meetings, set up local anti-racist sort of organisations, and that's sort of ongoing. It's sort of growing slowly, I think. I mean, fascism is not as big in this country as it is in other parts of like France, Germany, Italy, for instance. But I mean.